but checked himself when he saw that the cameras were watching his every move. Lydia Startwright had followed me onto the stage. She was there to adjudicate the meeting. It was she and Colonel Phelps who had insisted on waiting for me. Startwright was glad they had. Phelps was not. "Ladies and gentlemen," announced Lydia grandly, "the negotiating table is empty at Budapest, and the offensive lies waiting to happen. As a million troops face each other across no man's land, we ask the question, what price the Crimea?" Phelps got up to speak, but I beat him to it. "I know it's an old joke," I began, "but a simple anagram of Crimea is a crime." I paused. "That's the way I see it, and I would defy anyone to say that it isn't. Even Colonel Phelps over there would agree with me that it's high time the Crimea was put to bed permanently." Colonel Phelps nodded. "Where the Colonel and I differ is my belief that Russia has the better claim to the territory." It was a controversial remark. Phelps' supporters were well primed, and it took 10 minutes to restore order. Startwright quietened them all down and finally managed to get me to finish my point. "There was a good chance for all this nonsense to end barely 2 months ago. England and Russia were around the table discussing terms for a complete withdrawal of all English troops." There was a hush. Phelps had leaned back in his chair and was watching me carefully. "But then, along came the plasma rifle, codename Stonk." I looked down for a moment. "This Stonk was the key, the secret to a new offensive, and the possible restart of the war that has, thank God, been relatively free of actual fighting these past 8 years. But there's a problem. The offensive has been built on air. Despite all that has been said and done, the plasma rifle is a phony. Stonk does not work." There was an excited murmuring in the chamber. Phelps stared at me sullenly, eyebrow twitching. He whispered something to a brigadier who was sitting next to him. "The English troops are waiting for a new weapon that will not turn up. The Goliath Corporation have been playing the English government for a bunch of fools. Despite a £1 billion investment, the plasma rifle is about as much use in the Crimea as a broom handle." I sat down. The significance of this was not lost on anyone, either there or watching the programme live. The English Minister for War was at that moment reaching for his phone. He wanted to speak to the Russians before they did anything rash, like attack. Back at the hall in Swindon, Colonel Phelps had stood up.
"Large claims from someone who is tragically ill-informed," he intoned patronisingly. "We have all seen the destructive power of Stonk, and its effectiveness is hardly the reason for this talk."
"Prove it," I responded. "I see you have a plasma rifle with you. Lead us outside to the park and show us. You can try it on me if you so wish." Phelps paused, and in that pause he lost the argument. And the war. He looked at the soldier carrying the weapon, who looked back at him nervously. Phelps and his people left the stage to barracking from the crowd. He had been hoping to give his carefully rehearsed hour-long lecture over the memory of the lost brethren and the value of comradeship. He never spoke in public again. Within 4 hours, a ceasefire had been called for the first time in 131 years. Within 4 weeks, the politicians were around the table in Budapest. Within 4 months, every single English soldier was out of the peninsula. As for the Goliath Corporation, they were soon called to account over their deceit. They expressed wholly unconvincing ignorance of the whole affair and laid the blame entirely on Jack Shit. I had hoped the corporation would be chastised further, but at least it got Goliath off my back. Chapter 36. Married. Landon and I were married the same day as peace was declared in the Crimea. Landon told me it was to save on the fee for bell ringers. I looked around nervously when the vicar got to the bit about speak now or forever hold their peace, but there was no one there. I met with the Bronte Federation, and they soon got used to the idea of the new ending, especially when they realised that they were the only people who objected. I was sorry about Rochester's wounds and the burning down of his house, but I was very glad that he and Jane, after over 100 years of dissatisfaction, finally found the true peace and happiness that they both so richly deserved. Thursday next, a life in Spec Ops. The reception turned out to be bigger than we thought, and by 10 o'clock it had spilled out into Landon's garden. Boswell had got a little drunk, so I popped him in a cab and sent him to the Finis. Paige Turner had been getting along well with the saxophonist. No one had seen either of them for at least an hour. Landon and I were enjoying a quiet moment to ourselves. I squeezed his hand and asked, "Would you really have married Daisy if Briggs hadn't intervened?"
"I've got those answers you wanted, Sweet Pea."
Dad! He was attired in the full dress uniform of a colonel in the Chronoguard.
"I've been thinking about what you said, and I made a few inquiries."
"I'm sorry, Dad. I've got no idea what you're talking about."
"You remember, we spoke about 2 minutes ago."
"No." He frowned and looked at us both in turn, then at his watch.
"Great Scott!" he exclaimed. "I must be early. Damn these chronographs."
He tapped the dial and left quickly without saying another word.
"Your father?" asked Landon. "I thought you said he was on the run." "He was. He is. He will be. You know." "Sweet Pea," said my father again. "Surprised to see me?"
"In a manner of speaking."
"Congratulations to the two of you."
I glanced around at the party, still in full swing. Time was not standing still. It wouldn't be long before the Chronoguard tracked him down.
"To hell with SO12 Thursday," said he, divining my thoughts and taking a glass from a passing waiter. "I wanted to meet my son-in-law."
He turned to Landon, grasped his hand, and sized him up carefully.
"How are you, my boy? Have you had a vasectomy?"
"Well, no," replied Landon, vaguely embarrassed.
"How about a heavy tackle playing rugby?"
"No."
"Kick from a horse in the nether regions?"
"No."
"What about a cricket ball in the Ghoulies?"
"No."
"Good. Then we might get some grandchildren out of this fiasco. It's high time little Thursday here was popping out some sprogs instead of dashing around like some wild mountain piglet."
He paused.
"You're both looking at me very oddly."
"You were here not a minute ago." He frowned, raised an eyebrow, and looked about furtively.
"If it was me, and if I know me, I'd be hiding somewhere close by. Oh yes, look. Look there."
He pointed to a corner of the garden where a figure was hiding in the shadows behind the potting shed. He narrowed his eyes and thought through the most logical train of events.
"Let's see. I must have offered to do you a favour, done it, and come back, but a little out of time. Not uncommon in my line of work."
"What favour would I have asked you to do?" I ventured, still confused, but more than willing to play along.
"I don't know," said my father. "A burning question that has been much discussed over the years, but has so far remained unanswered."
I thought for a moment. "How about the authorship of the Shakespeare plays?" He smiled.
"Good point. I'll see what I can do."
He finished his drink.
"Well, congratulations again to the two of you. I must be off. Time waits for no man, as we say."
He smiled, wished us every happiness for the future, and departed.
"Can you explain just what is going on?" asked Landon, thoroughly confused, not so much by the events themselves as by the order in which they were happening.
"Not really."
"Have I gone, Sweet Pea?"
asked my father, who had returned from his hiding place behind the shed.
"Yes."
"Good. Well, I found out what you wanted to know. I went to London in 1610 and found that Shakespeare was only an actor with a potentially embarrassing sideline as a purveyor of bagged commodities in Stratford. No wonder he kept it quiet, wouldn't you?"
This was interesting indeed. "So, who wrote them? Marlowe? Bacon?"
"No, there was a bit of a problem, you see. No one had even heard of the plays, much less written them."
I didn't understand.
"What are you saying? There aren't any?"
"That's exactly what I'm saying. They don't exist. They were never written. Not by him, not by anyone." "I'm sorry," said Landon, unwilling to take much more of this. "But we saw Richard III only 6 weeks ago."
"Of course," said my father.
"Time is out of joint, big time. Obviously something had to be done. I took a copy of the complete works back with me and gave them to the actor Shakespeare in 1592 to distribute on a given timetable. Does that answer your question?"
I was still confused. So, it wasn't Shakespeare who wrote the plays?
Decidedly not, he agreed. Nor Marlowe, Oxford, De Vere, Bacon, or any of the others.
But that's not possible, exclaimed Landon.
On the contrary, replied my father. Given the huge timescale of the cosmos, impossible things are commonplace. When you've lived as long as I have, you'll know that absolutely anything is possible. Time is out of joint, O cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right.
You put that in? I asked, always assuming he was quoting from Hamlet and not the other way around. He smiled.
A small personal vanity that I'm sure will be forgiven Thursday. Besides, who's to know?
My father stared at his empty glass, looked around in vain for a waiter, then said,
Lavoisier will have locked on to me by now. He swore he'd catch me, and he's good. He should be. We were partners for almost 7 centuries. Just one more thing. How did the Duke of Wellington die?
I remembered he had asked me this once before. As I said, Dad, he died in his bed in 1852. Father smiled and rubbed his hands.
That's excellent news indeed. How about Nelson?
Shot by a French sniper at Trafalgar.
Really? Well, some you win. Listen, good luck the pair of you. A boy or a girl would be fine, one of each would be better.
He leaned closer and lowered his voice. I don't know when I'm going to be back, so listen carefully. Never buy a blue car or a paddling pool, stay away from oysters and circular saws, and don't be near Oxford in June 2016. Got it?
Yes, but...
Well, pip-pip, time waits for no man.
He hugged me again, shook Landon's hand, and then disappeared into the crowd before we could ask him anything more.
Don't even try to figure it out, I said to Landon, placing a finger to his lips. This is one area of spec ops that it's really better not to think about.
But if...
Landon, I said more severely.
No.
Bowden and Victor were at the party too. Bowden was happy for me, and had come easily to the realization that I wouldn't be joining him in Ohio, as either wife or assistant. He had been offered the job officially, but had turned it down. He said there was too much fun to be had at the Swindon Literatex, and he would reconsider it in the spring. Finisterre had taken his place. But at present, something else was preying on his mind. Helping himself to a stiff drink, he approached Victor, who was talking animatedly to an elderly woman he had befriended.
"What ho, Cable?"
Victor murmured, introducing his newfound friend before agreeing to have a quiet word with him.
"Good result, eh? Balls to the Bronte Federation. I'm with Thursday. I think the new ending is a whiz."
He paused and looked at Bowden.
"You've got a face longer than a Dickens novel. What's the problem? Worried about Felix VIII? "No, sir. I know they'll find him eventually. It's just that I accidentally mixed up the dust covers on the book that Jack Shit went into."
"You mean he's not with his beloved rifles?"
"No, sir. I took the liberty of slipping this book into the dust cover of The Plasma Rifle in War."
He handed over the book that had made its way into the prose portal. Victor looked at the spine and laughed. It was a copy of The Poems of Edgar Allan Poe.
"Have a look at page 26, said Bowden. "There's something funny going on in The Raven."
Victor opened the book and scanned the page. He read the first verse out loud.
"Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, o'er a plan to venge myself upon that cursed Thursday next, this air affair, so surprising, gives my soul such loathe despising, here I plot, my temper rising, rising from my jail of text. Get me out, I said, advising, pluck me from this jail of text, or I swear I'll wring your neck."
Victor shut the book with a snap.
"The last line doesn't rhyme very well, does it?"
"What do you expect?" replied Bowden.
"He's Goliath, not a poet." "But I read The Raven only yesterday," added Victor in a confused tone. "It wasn't like this then."
"No, no," explained Bowden. "Jack Shit is only in this copy. If we had put him in an original manuscript, then who knows what he might have done."
"Congratulations!" exclaimed Mycroft as he walked up to us.
Polly was with him and looked radiant in a new hat.
"We're both very happy for you," added Polly.
"Have you been working on the bookworms again?"